We would like to send out a special thanks to Ana Luisa for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Ana Luisa makes beautiful, sustainable jewelry at fair prices. For 10% off, go to shop.analuisa.com/cold and use the promo code COLD. Enjoy the show. January 18th, 1976. Colwyn Bay, Wales. The family of 15-year-old Peter Watts returns to their residence and discovers he has left behind a note to say that he has gone to see a friend. 10 hours later, Peter's unconscious body is discovered on the Euston Road underpass in London, over 250 miles away, and he dies after being rushed to the hospital. While Peter's injuries are consistent with a fall from a great height, his body and clothing appear to have been washed, suggesting that he was injured at another location before someone placed his body on the underpass. While an inquest jury rules that Peter's death was murder, there are no answers about who killed him or how he wound up in London to begin with. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we've got a pretty odd mystery to cover from the United Kingdom. The unexplained 1976 death of Peter Watts. As you might know, this coming weekend I'm going to be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon UK in London, and per tradition, whenever I attend a podcasting event, I always like to do an episode about an unsolved case from the host city on the very same week. And what's unique about this particular story is that the victim originally hailed from a town in Wales, but somehow wound up dead in London. One of this podcast's most highly requested cases is the 2007 disappearance of 14-year-old Andrew Gosden, which may be the most heavily discussed British mystery of the modern era. In case you're not familiar with the case, Andrew Gosden left his home in Doncaster and purchased a train ticket to London for reasons that have never been explained, and he remains a missing person to this day. Well, even though it's nowhere near as well known, the Peter Watts case has a number of similarities, but the key difference here is that the victim was found. Peter was a 15-year-old boy who left a note for his family to say that he was going out to see a friend, yet several hours later, he would somehow wind up dead over 250 miles away in London. Like Andrew Gosden, it's presumed that Peter hopped on a train to travel there, but because evidence in this case is so scant, and there were virtually no witnesses who could recall seeing him, we can't even be 100% certain of that. And what adds an extra element of weirdness to this case is that when Peter was found, his body and clothing were described as being impeccably clean, almost as if someone went to the trouble of washing Peter after he was seriously injured, and then proceeded to dump his body on the Euston Road underpass. Over the past four decades, there have been virtually no leads in the investigation, aside from a shocking eyewitness tip which came in around the 40th anniversary of Peter's death, which I'll be discussing later on. While investigators have always been pretty certain that Peter was the victim of foul play, they've never had all that much to work with, and there are essentially two mysteries here rolled into one. Who killed Peter, and how did he wind up in London to begin with? This is one of the more perplexing cases I've come across in quite some time, so we're going to have a lot to talk about on today's episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the death of Peter Watts. Thank you. Our story begins in the United Kingdom in 1976. Our central figure is 15-year-old Peter Watts, who lives with his parents, Percy and Hazel Watts, and his 17-year-old brother Mark, in Colwyn Bay, a seaside resort town located on the north coast of Wales, which overlooks the Irish Sea. Peter attends Arias Park Comprehensive School and is known for being a bright student and is a member of his school's clog dancing team. He has a particular passion for chemistry, as he keeps his own laboratory at home and spends much of his free time performing his own experiments. On the afternoon of Sunday, January the 18th, Peter was busy studying for his mock O-level exams, which were set to take place at school the following day. Back then, O-level exams were taken by secondary school students in the United Kingdom in order to test their basic knowledge in various subjects and before they would advance to more specialized courses of study. Years later, the O-level qualifications would be replaced by the General Certificate of Secondary Education, aka the GCSE. At around 3:30 p.m. that afternoon, Percy and Hazel took Mark out for a driver's lesson, and while Peter was asked if he wanted to go with them, he was too busy studying and decided to remain at the house. The family would be gone for just over a half hour, and when they returned home sometime after 4 p.m., Peter was not there. He left behind a note stating that he had gone to see a friend to help with the revision for the upcoming exams, though from what I can tell, he never actually named a specific friend in the note. Well, Peter never returned home that night, and concern only increased when he failed to show up at school for his O-level exams the following day. Peter's parents officially reported him missing to the North Wales Police, and while there was speculation that the pressure of the exams might have compelled Peter to run away, his family did not believe he was overly stressed. When he left for his driver's lesson, Mark said goodbye to Peter while he was inside his bedroom and said that everything appeared to be normal with him. Peter would remain a missing person for over a week, but on January the 26th, his family received a shocking piece of news. Peter had been found dead in London, over 250 miles away. At 1:33 a.m. on January the 19th, about 10 hours after he was last seen by his family, a taxi driver came across Peter's body in the westbound lane of the Euston Road underpass, located at the junction of Euston Road and Tottenham Court Road. At this point, Peter was unconscious and barely alive, and lying next to a pool of blood with a noticeable injury to the left side of his head. The driver immediately summoned an ambulance to the scene, and Peter was rushed to the nearby University College Hospital, but he died only about a half hour after his arrival, without ever regaining consciousness. Peter's injuries included a fractured skull, which was determined to be the cause of his death, and he also had cracked ribs, a broken left shoulder, and numerous internal injuries. Since Peter was not carrying any identification with him when he was found, he remained a John Doe for several days, until he was cross-checked with the missing persons report that had been filed for him in Colwyn Bay. Oddly, virtually all of Peter's personal possessions, including his eyeglasses, wristwatch, comb, and a gold ring he had recently received as a Christmas present from his parents, were missing and could not be recovered. The only item he still had on him was a pendant he was wearing, which was hidden beneath his shirt. The coroner felt there was nothing to indicate that Peter had been involved in a fight or been struck by a vehicle, and believed his injuries were consistent with a fall from a great height. Peter's body was discovered beneath an overpass, which was a 30-foot drop, but there was considerable doubt about whether he actually fell from that location. Peter had been found wearing an imitation leather jacket, but surprisingly, there were no scuffs or markings on them, which would have been expected if he fell 30 feet to his death onto some pavement. In addition, the wound in Peter's skull also did not have any sign of dirt or grit in it, even though his head had supposedly been injured by the fall. The coroner described Peter's body and clothing as being, quote-unquote, impeccably clean, and his pockets appeared to have been deliberately emptied, turned inside out, and brushed clean. The only flaw to be found on any of Peter's items of clothing were scuff marks on the heels of his shoes, as if someone had been dragging his body while he was unconscious. The total lack of forensic evidence led to speculation that Peter had been seriously injured at another location, before someone went to the trouble of bathing his body and washing his clothes before redressing him, and then proceeded to dump his body on the Euston Road underpass. Before he discovered Peter on the underpass, the taxi driver had driven through a tunnel with a second taxi following close behind him. According to the second cab driver, before he entered the tunnel, he recalled seeing a green car emerge from it in the opposite lane, and the vehicle proceeded to turn left and drove straight through the traffic lights. Could the occupants of that green car have dumped Peter's body on the underpass? Of course, in addition to the odd circumstances of how he died, the other big mystery is what Peter was doing in London to begin with, as his family claimed he did not know anyone from the city. When Peter's case started generating publicity, a British rail clerk came forward who believed he had sold Peter a train ticket at the booking office of the Colwyn Bay Railway Station sometime between 4:15 and 4:20 p.m. on January the 18th, less than an hour after his family last saw him at the residence. According to the clerk, a young man matching Peter's description purchased a day-return ticket to the city of Chester, England, located just over 40 miles east of Colwyn Bay, near the English-Welsh border. The clerk said that he remembered this transaction because the young man paid with a £10 note, and since the ticket cost £2.04, he had to open the safe to make change. Indeed, Peter had recently received a £10 note as a Christmas present, and it was discovered to be missing from his home. Peter also had ties to Chester, as he was a train enthusiast who sometimes traveled there to go train spotting. In fact, during the week where Peter was unidentified, his father had actually taken a trip to Chester to search for him. The train the ticket was purchased for originated in the Welsh town of Holyhead and would have arrived at the Colwyn Bay station at 5:18 p.m. After the train traveled to Chester, it would have continued southeast until it arrived at the Euston Railway Station at approximately 9:15 p.m., and the station was not too far from the spot where Peter's body was found. But while the clerk thought there was a good chance that Peter was the young man he sold the train ticket to, he could not say with 100% certainty that it was him. The issue is that other than the clerk, investigators could not find one single eyewitness who could recall having seen Peter on the afternoon or evening of January the 18th, or during the early morning hours of the 19th. The police went to a lot of trouble posting and circulating Peter's missing persons flyer to commuters who took the train from Colwyn Bay to Chester and to London, but none of them seemed to recognize Peter or have any recollection of him on the day he left his home. This made Peter's family wonder if he never actually took the train to London, but was instead forcibly abducted from the residence and driven there. 4 months after Peter was found, a 9-man inquest jury was held into his death at St. Pancras Coroner's Court, featuring testimony from a number of eyewitnesses. The Watts family dismissed the possibility that Peter's death was a suicide, believing there was no way he would have traveled to another city several hours away from home in order to take his own life. The authorities also do not believe that Peter's death was the result of an accidental fall from the overpass, and that if he was killed at another location, someone else had to have placed his body on the underpass. In the end, the jury returned a unanimous verdict in which they concluded that Peter's death was a murder by a person or persons unknown. But unfortunately, the subsequent investigation did not go anywhere, as both the coroner and the lead detective openly acknowledged that this was one of the most baffling cases they had ever seen. After Peter's body was returned to his family, they held a funeral for him in Colwyn Bay before he was cremated. The Wattses ultimately decided that remaining in their original home would create too many painful memories for them, so they moved to the nearby town of Penryn Bay less than a year after they lost Peter. The case would fade from the spotlight for the next 4 decades, until ITV News London decided to run a new report on Peter's story in January of 2016 to commemorate the 40th anniversary. By this point, Peter and Hazel Watts had both passed away, but Peter's brother Mark agreed to be interviewed and said that their parents felt immense guilt over the possibility that Peter may have wound up dead because he ran away from home since they failed him in some way. The London Metropolitan Police's Special Casework Investigative Team stated that they were working on Peter's case, but needed anyone out there with information to come forward. Well, sure enough, it wasn't long before investigators were contacted by a retired taxi driver named John Barney, who had watched the ITV news report, and became convinced he may have personally witnessed Peter's death. According to Barney, sometime in 1976, he had been driving along the Euston Road underpass when he noticed a young man climbing over the railings onto the road. Almost immediately thereafter, a police car with blue flashing lights drove past him at a high rate of speed and hit the young man. This caused the victim to fly through the air and land in the lane Barney was driving in, so he instantly hit the brakes and stopped only about 6 feet from the victim. Varney said that the young man moved for a brief period of time and looked directly at him before his eyes closed. When Varney attempted to climb out of his cab, the police car pulled up right next to him before one of the two officers inside climbed out and yelled at him to go. Varney then proceeded to drive away and assumed that since the police were at the scene, they would take care of the situation. However, Varney said that the incident haunted him for the next 40 years, and when he saw the news report about Peter Watts' death, he became convinced that this was the young man he saw get hit by the police car. Well, Varney would be interviewed by investigators, but unfortunately, it does not look like this lead ever went anywhere, and the investigation has once again reached a standstill. So after 46 years, the actual truth about why Peter Watts traveled to London and how he wound up dead remain a perplexing, unsolved mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to talk about a special brand called Anna Luisa, who would become great supporters of The Trail Went Cold. Anna Luisa produces high-quality, beautiful, and sustainable jewelry such as earrings, necklaces, and rings, and it does so with the planet in mind. From packing to products, the jewelry is always 100% carbon neutral and 100% water neutral, and it's also very unique and affordable, with prices starting as low as $39. Since new jewelry collections are always released every Friday, you'll always find a large selection in which you can shop for yourself or find the perfect gift for a special someone. When Anna Luisa started supporting our show a few months ago, they let me pick out some pieces, and of course I ordered a gold initial necklace with the letter R on it for Robin. Ordinarily, I wasn't someone who used to wear necklaces, but I've been enthusiastically wearing that one ever since. And of course, I gifted my thank you necklace to someone whom I really needed to thank for their support, and they greatly appreciated it. I definitely believe that Anna Luisa jewelry is an ideal gift for holidays, birthdays, and other special occasions. And I'm excited to say that we have an Anna Luisa deal for you. You can treat yourself or your loved ones by using our specialized promo code, COLD, to get 10% off. I absolutely recommend Anna Luisa because they are a great brand who makes beautiful, sustainable jewelry. So to get 10% off, go to shop.analuisa.com/cold and use the promo code COLD. Once again, that's shop.analuisa.com/cold and the promo code is COLD. Thank you and enjoy the rest of this episode. Anyway, if you've ever listened to this podcast, you'll know that one particular type of mystery I've always been interested in is when someone winds up dead under suspicious circumstances after traveling to a location they had no reason to be at. In these cases, there are always two big mysteries. How did the victim die, and how did they wind up at this faraway location? For some other examples of this, there's the death of Judy Smith, who vanished during a business trip to Philadelphia before her remains were discovered in a remote mountainous area of North Carolina, 600 miles away. There's the saga of Blair Adams, who made an unexplained cross-country trip from British Columbia to Knoxville, Tennessee, where he was killed under very bizarre circumstances. And there's the death of David Lewis, who vanished from his hometown of Amarillo, Texas, and was struck and killed by a vehicle just over 24 hours later on a highway in Yakima County, Washington, located nearly 1,600 miles away. Compared to these cases, I guess Peter Watts' 250-mile trip from Colwyn Bay, Wales to London might not be that extreme, but he disappeared without warning during a narrow window of time while his family was out of the house and was discovered dead only 10 hours after he was last seen. And what adds to the frustration is that Peter's case took place all the way back in 1976, so the necessary technology did not exist to leave behind a digital trail of his movements. During the intro, I compared this case to the unsolved disappearance of 14-year-old Andrew Gosden, which I may cover on The Trail Went Cold at some point. But in case you're not familiar with his story, I wanted to provide a brief synopsis of what happened. Andrew lived with his family in the Balby suburb of Doncaster, located in South Yorkshire, and he left his home to head for school on the morning of Friday, September the 14th, 2007. But instead of hopping on the school bus, Andrew decided to go to an ATM and nearly emptied his bank account to withdraw £200. After his parents left for work, Andrew returned home to change out of his school uniform and decided to walk to Doncaster Railway Station without leaving a note behind for anyone. He then proceeded to purchase a one-way train ticket to London, located over 160 miles away. A witness would later recall having sat next to Andrew on the train, where he spent most of his time playing with his PlayStation portable video game console. After the train arrived at London's King's Cross Railway Station, CCTV footage would capture Andrew exiting out the main entrance at 11:25 a.m., but after that, he was never heard from again, and he is still a missing person nearly 15 years later. To this day, no one has any real idea about why Andrew decided to make this unexplained train trip to London, but one of the most prominent theories is that he was a victim of human trafficking. In fact, in December of 2021, two unnamed men were arrested and held on suspicion of kidnap and human trafficking in relation to Andrew's case, but they have since been released under investigation so that devices which were seized from both men can be analyzed. The authorities have been very tight-lipped about sharing details with the public, but they've said these devices could take 6 months to 1 year to analyze, so at the time of this recording, Andrew Gosden's disappearance is still an unsolved cold case, and we really don't know how much significance this recent development has to the investigation. I sometimes see Andrew's case brought up in online discussions about Peter Watts' death, but even though there are a number of similarities, I do not believe the two cases are connected, given the 31-year gap between them. Obviously, the key difference is that Peter was found, whereas Andrew is still missing, but Andrew's case did have the advantage of more advanced technology in order to track his movements. We definitely know that Andrew bought a train ticket to London and arrived there because he was captured on CCTV at King's Cross Railway Station, but we don't have that in Peter's case or any concrete evidence to prove that Peter even took the train at all. We had a witness who specifically remembered sitting next to Andrew during his train trip, but not one person could recall having seen Peter on his train, or anywhere for that matter, on the day he traveled to London. We do have a rail clerk who believed he sold a train ticket to Peter, but even he can't be 100% certain it was the same guy, and there are no other independent eyewitnesses who can corroborate his story and establish how Peter wound up at the location he did. For this reason, Peter's family have always believed that he did not leave their house voluntarily and travel to the railway station to purchase a train ticket, but was instead forcibly abducted. During interviews, Peter's brother Mark has stated that even though the rail clerk was not entirely sure he sold a ticket to Peter, his statement was picked up by the press and reported and accepted as fact, even though the clerk could have been mistaken. But if Peter was abducted from his residence and driven to London, the obvious question is, why? Unfortunately, there is so little evidence to work with in this case, and only a limited amount of information. There's also virtually no forensic evidence available, and while I'm sure no one was thinking about this sort of thing back in 1976, it is kind of a shame that Peter's family had him cremated, because for all we know, there could have been potential DNA evidence on his body which belonged to his killer. And aside from a shocking tip that came in 40 years after the fact, which I'll discuss later on, we've had no eyewitnesses who can provide any insight into what happened. In recent years, both Mark and the cold case investigators have been very open about the fact that unless someone with information about what happened decides to come forward, there may be no chance of a resolution here. At the time Peter's death took place, his case got quite a bit of media coverage in the United Kingdom, and due to the baffling nature of how Peter died, the story even got some international coverage, as a press release was published in a number of North American newspapers. Though I wouldn't say it was the most tactful press release, since the headline referred to the story as the quote-unquote case of the clean corpse. The article referred to the case as an Agatha Christie-type mystery, and by today's standards, this particular passage seems a bit problematic. Quote, "Police now have a theory. Perhaps Peter innocently agreed to go home with one of the homosexuals who haunt Euston Station. Perhaps he realized what was happening and jumped out a window or down a flight of stairs in an effort to escape." End quote. I mean, given how little evidence there is, I guess it's not impossible that Peter could have had some sort of secret gay hookup when he arrived in London, but gay people aren't ghosts, so I don't think they exactly haunt train stations. Peter's case continued to get media coverage until the inquest jury officially ruled that his death was a murder, but shortly thereafter, it seemed to completely fade from the spotlight, until ITV decided to produce a 40th anniversary news segment about Peter's death in 2016. The case started receiving a bit of exposure again, but unfortunately, it sounds like the investigation has once again hit a brick wall, and they are no closer to figuring it out now than they were back in 1976. But of course, in all cases where a victim winds up dead at an unexpected location, we have to go back and start at the very beginning and establish a timeline. The last time Peter's parents and his brother saw him at their residence in Colwyn Bay was at around 3:30 p.m. on the afternoon of January the 18th, and his body was discovered in London at 1:33 a.m. on the morning of January 19th. So obviously, an awful lot had to happen during a window of approximately 10 hours. On the 18th, Peter was studying hard for his mock O-level exams, which were scheduled to take place at school the following day, and while his family said he was very focused on it, they did not believe he had become so stressed and overwhelmed about the situation that he would decide to just run away. But traveling from Colwyn Bay to London is a 4-hour train ride each way, so if Peter elected to make the trip on his own accord, he did not seem to have much concern about taking and passing the exams on Monday morning. It does seem very calculated that Peter would choose to write a note and leave the house while his parents were taking his brother out for a driver's lesson, so you have to wonder if there was something going on with Peter that his family did not know about. Even though Peter left behind a note stating that he was going to see a friend to help them prepare for the exams, it does not sound like he named a specific person, and none of Peter's friends ever came forward to confirm he was planning to see them that afternoon. So it seems obvious that this was just a cover story in order to prevent Peter's family from immediately becoming worried once they discovered he was gone. But of course, the note is one of the biggest holes in the Watts' theory that Peter was abducted from his home unless somebody forced him to write it against his will. I guess it would all depend on how much credence you put into the eyewitness sighting from the clerk at the Colwyn Bay railway station who believed he sold Peter a ticket to Chester. This transaction supposedly took place sometime between 4:15 and 4:20 p.m., only about an hour after the Wattses went out for the driver's lesson, so if Peter willingly left his house and walked to the station, then the timeline would match up. The confusing part is that the train to Chester did not actually arrive until 5:18 p.m., so what was Peter doing during that 1-hour window after he purchased the ticket? Sure, he could have just spent that time hanging around the station, but it is very odd that other than the rail clerk, police could not find one eyewitness who recalled having seen Peter at the station or on the train that day, even though they went all out at circulating his missing persons flyer. Now, obviously, I would not take this as evidence that Peter was never there, as I'm sure your average commuter is not going to take note of everyone they travel on a train with, and if Peter did not interact with anyone, then he may not have done anything to leave a memorable impression. However, as I mentioned on this podcast countless times, false eyewitness sightings in cases like this are so common, as many people just have a natural instinct to help, so if they believe they may have seen a missing person, they'll come forward and share this information, even though it often turns out they mistook the victim for someone else, or got mixed up about the date they saw them. But here, no one seemed to have any recollection of Peter at all, even though he was a fairly distinct-looking young man, because of his longish hair and large eyeglasses. So could it be possible that the clerk was mistaken, and he actually sold a ticket to another individual who looked like Peter? Well, if so, how come no eyewitnesses had a recollection of that person? Now, even though Peter's family claimed that he had no ties to London and did not know anyone who lived there, he had traveled to Chester on previous occasions in order to conduct such hobbies as train spotting. So if Peter was feeling a bit overwhelmed about his exams, perhaps he decided to make an impromptu trip to Chester in order to spend some time unwinding by watching trains or something. One of the most unusual aspects of Andrew Gosden's disappearance is that he purchased a one-way train ticket to London, but the ticket Peter supposedly purchased to Chester was a day return ticket, which would indicate that he was planning to return home that very same day. But I guess it's possible that Peter could have fallen asleep before he arrived in Chester and missed his stop, and if he did not wake up for a few hours, he would have been forced to get off the train when it arrived at the Euston Railway Station in London at 9:15 p.m. However, even though we're talking about the pre-cell phone era, if Peter wound up in London by mistake, it is odd that he wouldn't have gone to a payphone to call his family and ask for help. And according to the clerk, Peter used a 10-pound note to purchase a ticket, which cost £2.04, so he presumably would have had enough money to purchase a return train ticket home if he needed one. But once again, there were no eyewitnesses who could recall seeing Peter in London on that particular night, and there's a 4-hour window between when the train arrived and his body was discovered when Peter's whereabouts are unaccounted for. I know that one of the most common theories in the Andrew Gosden case is that he was the victim of human trafficking and was lured by a predator who somehow convinced him to make an impromptu trip to London. Theoretically, the same thing could have happened to Peter, but of course there was no internet back in 1976, so if Peter had secretly been communicating with someone who managed to convince him to travel to London, there is no record of any of their interactions anywhere. It's equally as possible that Peter elected to take this trip without any outside influence and made this decision for reasons which only made sense to himself or because he suffered some sort of complete mental breakdown. Peter's family never mentioned him having any sort of mental illness and said that he seemed completely normal the last time they saw him. But that doesn't mean there couldn't have been something going on with Peter which they were completely unaware of, as people were far less open about discussing their mental health struggles 46 years ago. It is tempting to believe that Peter's death could have been a suicide after intentionally making a 30-foot leap from the overpass into the Euston Road underpass, but his family insisted that he wasn't suicidal. Now, I've studied enough of these stories to know that people who show no signs of being depressed or suicidal will sometimes take everyone by complete surprise by ending their own life. And there are cases like the Gail Delano disappearance from Unsolved Mysteries, where suicidal people have inexplicably decided to travel hundreds of miles away from their hometown and their families in order to go through with the act. So what if Peter decided to travel to London to take his own life? Well, it would have been really easy for investigators to write off Peter's death as a suicide or even an accidental fall from the overpass, but they have never believed the evidence supports the scenario, which is why an inquest jury returned a unanimous verdict that Peter was the victim of foul play. Apparently, the location where his body was found was close enough to the edge of the overpass that it would have been logistically impossible for Peter to jump or fall from there and land in that particular spot. This is why it's been theorized that Peter might have been seriously injured at another location before someone dumped his body into the underpass, perhaps to make it look like he suffered an accidental fall there. The way the coroner described Peter as being, quote-unquote, impeccably clean, suggests that someone may have gone to the trouble of washing his body and clothing before redressing and disposing of him. What makes the situation even weirder is that Peter was unconscious when his body was found, and he only died after he was rushed to the hospital. So if this cleaning scenario is true, then Peter technically still would have been alive while all this was going on. Now, to be fair, Peter's father, Percy Watts, once said in an interview that his son was very concerned with cleanliness and hygiene, stating, quote, if he received a small scratch, he had to have an antiseptic for it. It was an attitude which we had been joking about at home, end quote. So I guess it's possible that Peter was just a guy who always went out of his way to ensure that his body and clothing were very clean, and the coroner just exaggerated the whole situation. But it is very unusual that the only markings to be found on Peter's clothes were scuff marks on the heels of his shoes, and it's also very troubling that most of Peter's personal items, including his identification, eyeglasses, wristwatch, and gold ring, were nowhere to be found at the scene and have never been recovered. If the scene was staged, and the responsible party wanted to make it look like Peter fell from the overpass, then they may have gotten way too clever for their own good. If Peter's body and clothing were not so clean, then the police might have been more inclined to believe he died at that location, but it sounds like someone really wanted to go the extra mile to destroy potential forensic evidence. It's worth noting that the autopsy showed no indication that Peter was sexually assaulted, so I don't think they were trying to get rid of any semen evidence, and of course back in 1976, no one would have been thinking of DNA. Perhaps all of Peter's personal belongings were removed from the scene intentionally to give off the false impression that he was robbed by someone who pushed him off the overpass, but you have to wonder what actually happened to Peter in order to compel someone to go to all this trouble. The coroner still believed that Peter's injuries were consistent with a fall from a great height, so if this fall took place elsewhere, then there was obviously a vested interest in ensuring that he was not found at that particular location. The Euston Road underpass really does not seem like the ideal spot to stage a scene, since it often contains heavy vehicular traffic, so if someone dumped Peter's body there, they got incredibly lucky that they were not seen by any eyewitnesses. Perhaps they were hoping that everyone would believe that Peter was the victim of a hit-and-run accident, as the underpass is a very dangerous place for pedestrians who are forbidden from walking down there. But that ruse didn't really work, as Peter's injuries were not consistent with being struck by a vehicle, and it sounds like they weren't consistent with him being physically assaulted either. Unfortunately, the only eyewitness who has ever claimed to have seen anything incriminating on the night Peter was killed is the retired cab driver John Varney, who did not come forward until 40 years after the fact. Varney claims that he saw a young man matching Peter's description get struck by a police car containing at least two officers, and given how long it took him to share this story, I can understand why it's easy to be skeptical about it. Varney claims that since the police told him to leave the scene, he assumed they would handle the situation, but it was only after he watched a news segment about Peter's case 4 decades later that he became convinced that he might have witnessed his death. However, Peter's story did get quite a bit of media coverage in the UK back in 1976, so it is surprising that Varney wouldn't have heard about it at the time and put two and two together. I will admit that a cover-up involving Peter getting hit by a police car is an intriguing scenario, because a police officer might be the type of person who would be thinking about stuff like forensic evidence and go to the trouble of cleaning Peter's body and clothing in order to stage a fake death scene. But once again, the coroner did not believe that Peter's injuries were consistent with being struck by a car, even though Varney literally described the young man he saw as flying through the air after he was hit. And if Peter was struck by a police car on the Euston Road underpass, it really doesn't make much sense for them to remove his body from the scene and clean it before returning there. Given that pedestrians are not supposed to be walking on the underpass, if the police struck him down there and it was legitimately an accident, then they probably wouldn't have even gotten into any real trouble to begin with, and there was no real need for a cover-up. I don't know if Varney is making this story up, or if he might have witnessed a completely different accident with a police car which did not involve Peter, but I'm not buying that this is how Peter was killed. If the coroner is accurate, and Peter's injuries were caused by a fall from a great height at another location, was he intentionally pushed from a high place? Or could this have been an accidental fall, which came about as the result of a confrontation or altercation with another person? Like I mentioned earlier, Peter was technically still alive until after he arrived at the hospital, so there's a possibility he could have been saved if someone had immediately called for medical attention. But since they went to the trouble of cleaning his body and moving it, it appears that the responsible party wanted to completely disassociate themselves from what happened. I know I mocked that sensationalistic press release that Peter may have been picked up by a gay person at the Euston Railway Station and was seriously injured when he jumped out a window or down a flight of stairs to get away from them, but truthfully, given the time period, that is the type of scenario I could see someone going to great lengths to cover up. Of course, I'm definitely not going to say that's what happened, since nothing has ever been presented to indicate that Peter was secretly gay, but since we have so little evidence to work with, I suppose anything's possible, and it certainly would provide a potential explanation for why he would travel to London without telling his family what he was doing. That's ultimately the biggest issue with this case. Putting aside the logistics of how and why Peter was killed, we still have zero idea about why he decided to leave his home to make this 250-mile trip in the first place. I mean, if you actually believe the theory that Peter was struck by a police car and his death was covered up, that's fine. But it still doesn't account for how he got from point A to point B. This is why Peter's family have always clung to the theory that he never took the train and was abducted from his residence by force. But what kind of person would have had such a vendetta against Peter that they would feel compelled to kidnap him and bring him 250 miles to London in order to kill him? However, perhaps the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Peter was not abducted or take the train, but was instead picked up at his home by someone and left of his own volition. This would account for why Peter left a note behind about going to help a friend prepare for their exams, because he may have thought he would be back later that same day, but for whatever reason, Peter was taken to London, and something went horribly wrong, which led to him being killed. There definitely still would have been enough time to drive to London during the 10-hour window before Peter's body was found. While Peter's family did not believe he had any personal problems or reasons to run away, perhaps something was going on in his life which they did not know about. If Peter's body and clothing were cleaned before he was dumped on the underpass, it was definitely a very odd strategy, but it technically did work. Since virtually no evidence was left behind, and no one has any real clue about what happened all these years later, it's almost like they got away with the perfect crime. I think one important key detail might be the sighting of the green car, which was seen emerging from a tunnel and driving away from the Euston Road underpass right before Peter's body was found. It's very possible that the driver of that car had just dumped Peter there and managed to get away before any witnesses caught them in the act. But for all we know, that green car may have just been driven by some random innocent motorists, and they have no connection to the crime. Otherwise, there just isn't a whole lot to work with here, and this continues to remain one of the more perplexing cases I've ever seen for the United Kingdom. I'm afraid the authorities might be correct in that the only way this case winds up being solved is if the right person comes forward with information. So this is why I'm sending out an open invitation. If you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of Peter Watts, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released another joint bonus episode with my friend Charlie from the Crime Lines podcast, in which we discussed a very famous case from Unsolved Mysteries that wound up being solved, the murder of Shannon Moore by her husband, Dave Davis. In addition, I dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1994 murder of Matt Flores. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Gabriella DF, Lynn N, Chelsea S, and Amy S. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that later this summer, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th until the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a number of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes, so in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, just a few days after this episode's release, I will finally be on Podcast Row at CrimeCon UK in London, which I had to miss last year due to travel restrictions, but I'm very excited to be attending this year, as I have not been to the UK since the 1980s when I was a kid. I have a feeling that some of you listeners will also be in attendance, and if so, feel free to come say hi to me at my booth on Podcast Row. So everyone, have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Bye.